For Doyle, interfering with the military was an expression of his passionate commitment to nonviolence. When the case of the Camden 28 came to trial, Doyle and the other defendants acted as their own attorneys. They became the only group who destroyed draft records that received an acquittal from the jury. In the spring of 1980, the Enquirer's Today magazine devoted their cover story to Doyle's life, work, and nonviolent philosophy. 1 year later, they suggested that he visit his native Ireland and that he write his impressions of the conflicts in Northern Ireland for Today magazine. He went, and there he met with Michael McCallisky and Bernadette Devlin McCallisky, who were still recovering from murder attempts which left 3 bullets in Michael and 8 in Bernadette. Doyle visited the Mays prison shortly after Bobby Sands had begun his hunger strike. When Sands was buried, Doyle attended the funeral and then spent that evening with the Sands family. He also met with Andy Tyree, the supreme commander of the Ulster Defense Association. The article that resulted from this visit was published last July. Father Michael Doyle moved to America, the Camden Diocese, in 1959 after graduating from Peter Seminary in Wexworth, Ireland. For the past 12 years, he's been the pastor of the Sacred Heart Church in Camden. He tries to provide nourishment for the souls of the people in his economically depressed parish, but a good deal of his time is spent finding food for those who are hungry and helping with housing and heating problems. Michael Doyle, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
What can the church do? What do you see the church's role as being in a poor neighborhood in terms of charity or social change?
Well, the church is a community of people who have a vision of life in which there are people have an equality and respect regardless of their position, their power, their economic status, whatever. It's a different kind of idea. And when people come together with that kind of vision, then if they're really a church and they truly follow that, they're going to come in conflict with the prevailing secular institutions, which do not, no matter what they say, they do not look at people with compassionate eyes, and they do not provide for an equality and a good sharing of this world's resources. So the church has to very often take on that struggle, and a church is most vital and most clear in its statement when it stands with the poor. And it first of all must, as all human life must, respond to the immediate need. It cannot speak philosophically about social change if somebody is dying on the doorstep. So you must stop, bend, lift, and so on. And that must be done. Every church that exists, no matter where it exists, has no real vitality unless it is actually giving help to those who are, deprived. That's the first responsibility of it. It just has no purpose. It's a club that sort of soothes people's minds, and if it doesn't deal with the poor. And in fact, I think the gospel that is least of my church anyway, the Christian gospel, puts us into a position that we cannot approve of or promote the notion that getting ahead, which would mean getting a lot of money for yourself, is really an acceptable direction. So it a church in a very affluent area would somehow be called upon not to bless the way it is, but challenge the way it is now, and get people involved with helping the poor. That's the first thing. And then the second thing is that it must bring its strength against the forces that would create systems of injustice. And there it's quite a difficult thing to do, because it cannot provide anything more than a moral, challenge. It cannot use force like physical force. It must use the persuasion. It must battle for the consciousness of the society, stir it. It must be able to suffer for its truth. It must be Gandhian, really, in its approach. It must be a non-violent challenge, but real. And it must be a thorn in the side of the secular society. The problem for us is that very often the church, the synagogue, the religious institution takes on the trappings of the society in which it is placed, and it has the same sort of middle class, upper class mentality that the society has, and it is very nice. And the political structure uses it to help to give some sort of approval to its own action. You'll find that things will begin with prayer. Even the military, which at present time is making the most barbaric weapon since the beginning of time, will put aside funds for its chaplains. You see, as somebody said to bless the ammunition, you know, as we pass it along. So that's the terrible problem. And if church people or people working in ministry, if they don't watch it, and if they're not really careful, the society will use them like you use a candle on the table. It gives a sort of a glow to the situation, but isn't really important. And they'll trot you out and put you forward as a sort of a sign of that this is really good stuff, but. And so very, very, very often the church and the society will be just quite cozy together. And that's what I say that the church has to sort of, in its leadership, challenge. It must challenge society.
Well, not everybody in the church shares your point of view. Do you ever get in trouble for the role that you see the church as having?
Well, I suppose I have been in trouble. Trouble would be a very important part of it. Like, if you're not in some kind of trouble, or if there's not a tussle for the truth going on, then, like, nothing really is happening at all. And I myself tend to be polite. I don't find it easy to challenge anyone. I sort of would very easily go along with people and be nice about things. And people are like that. People don't want to be disturbed, nor do they want to disturb. But at the same time, one has to sort of gather some strength from somewhere and really do get into trouble, which would mean basically to challenge, to stand up and say, no, you cannot do that. If I listen to, you know, the president and he says that he's concerned about the people, and he's concerned about all the citizens. But what I see him doing would be putting forward, as they did yesterday, the day before, confirming a budget of $200 billion for weapons to defend us against whatever, you see. But I would say to him, stop, feed the people, rebuild Camden, you know, put money aside to train and have people become creative, you know. And you start off with the principle that one human being is indeed the greatest reality that does exist. And that is the basic principle of the church.
It's nearly Christmas time, and that's a very trying time for people who don't have much money, because it puts quite a strain on the budget to be buying gifts. But also it's the time of the year when it starts to get really cold and you have to face heating bills, which just start to get high this time of year. What are some of the immediate things that you have to work on? What are some of the problems people come to you with as the pastor of the church?
Yeah, well, first off, I'd like to say that it's a very hard time to be poor in this present time in our civilization, because we don't have neighborhood where we sort of can be together in our condition. The poor watch more television and listen to more radio than do those who are better off. Most stations, unfortunately, are in the hands of the merchants. And so they're always selling you something and providing a sort of a notion that you could be happy if you had this. So you could never settle You're always being tempted to have more. So you are creating a very unsettled poor, a very desperate poor. Christmas time is used extensively around the world by the merchants to make money. It is the best commercial come-on that exists at Christmas time. Now, the people then become desperate. There's a rise in crime. People are so unhappy not to be able to provide for others that which the people who have money can do. So they come. And this year in Camden, where I am, well, the people are coming in droves looking for Christmas baskets. At the present time, we have 300 families asking us to put the food on their table for Christmas Day. And that involves a turkey, a ham, a chicken maybe for older people maybe who wouldn't be able to deal with a turkey. So we have to somehow provide that. You can't say no to it. How can you say no to a person's Christmas dinner in a world of plenty? And so that's where we're at. And $10, just simple $10 that buys a turkey at the farmer's market, and we can provide the rest of it, that $10 can make a family happy. So that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to sort of to get the money to be able to buy that one ham or turkey or chicken to make a centerpiece to a basket and then put the rest to it and make somebody happy. But people, we have one more week to go till Christmas. And it's, at this present time, we have 300. Last year, we had 120. But already we have 300.
When people come to you with heating problems, say their heat's been turned off or they have a broken window that's not being fixed, do you ever play an advocacy role for them?
We do. We do that too. And we try to... We have a full-time social worker who does that kind of fighting for them. And we also, when we can't succeed with that, we send out someone to fix it. And we try to do that when the things are desperate. But you can't fix all the problems of Camden. Camden is Disasterville. It just, you know, is unfair. And as I look at this whole scene, I see that the society in which we presently live, by exclusion, by economics and so forth, is creating a dumping ground like a Camden, where you put away those who are unwanted in your own neighbourhood. And then the problem is that our present administration announces that they will depend upon the private sector to solve the problem. There is no private sector going to solve the problem of Camden. It's a desperate situation. And we have 85,000 people. We have so many poor people, 60% unemployment. The crime rate doubled the national average. And a tax increase this year of 88% in one shot. So the whole thing is unworkable. And what I see is that a Camden has to scream in this land of plenty and announce itself that 85,000 people have a right to a better deal. And, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Well, there's no way you can pursue happiness in that situation, and it's impossible. So the church has to sort of and scream at the government and so forth to stop wasting money on weapons that are for the destruction of the earth and have nothing left. When this man, this president, talks about the fact that he won't raise taxes and he will increase the military spending, what he is talking about is taking from the children. That's what he's talking about. Cut every program.
What kind of dialogue is happening within the church that you're aware of now? What kind of debate over American policy and how that's affecting the people of your parishes?
Well, for the first time in the history of the American church, that the Catholic bishops, and they have some clout, are beginning to come together to deal with the reality of nuclear madness. And if they don't do it, and if all the churches don't do it, and if we will be condemned as the most apathetic, insane generation that ever lived, because we stood by when something was being arranged and designed that it would destroy the whole earth, and didn't scream about it, that the world's, it's like the world's on fire. The fact that we can be so unconscious about it, and the fact that we can go along thinking that all will be well, and it's true that there never has been, since the beginning of history, and long before it was anything that we can get to, there never has been a weapon designed by humanity that has not been used, ever.
I know that you have a very strongly nonviolent philosophy, and on a large level that would relate to war and military operations. But on a smaller level, on a more individual level, there's a lot of crime in the city that you live in.
Sure.
How do you work both of those things into your sermons, for instance, and into the conversations you have?
You talk about the fact that like today, for example, listening to the president, he said in speaking of Poland, "Violence begets violence," said he. Well, that's the truth, but it's quite a project to follow that, you see. But that's what we try to do. I've been mugged only twice in my, you know, years in Camden. But at the time, I didn't feel any hate for the people who were doing it. Frightened a bit, but not hate. I just know that people can only take so much, and that there's such hardship and misery in homes that children are dealt with violently very often in language. Violent language is so bad for young children, and the conditions, like the inner soul of a child being raised in Camden should not have to have a vision of the world that is Camden. You know, broken, hard, desperate, neglected, nothing soothing or comforting. How can young people raised in harsh conditions? I am amazed. I am amazed that the people are not more violent. I'm amazed at that. And that's very encouraging to me, because the conditions sometimes are so desperate that... So I can keep that before my mind, you know, that people have a hard time. And personally, you can't say about yourself that you would be always able. You'd hope you'd be able to be nonviolent. You want to be like that. But it doesn't mean that when you would be really tested that you wouldn't be desperate, you see. But you want to go in that direction that Martin Luther King said, which no one said it better, that an eye for an eye leaves everyone blind. And of course, that's the way to go. The thing about it is that if people got together and they had support and they had community and they had people to worry about them, it's easier to be nonviolent. The isolation and creates violence. If you have a neighborhood and people caring about each other, you can stand up to it. And in my own case, I'm never alone. I have so many people who are my friends, or, you know, I'm not lost in some unknown place with danger around me. I'm supported, you know.
Do you feel like you've been able to create that kind of community for other people?
Well, the people who come around me know where I stand. They know where I stand on militarism, and they know where I stand on... I'm not at all supportive of the military. I just find that as the direction that will lead us to destruction. It always has, never has solved anything, militarism. And so they know where I stand, and I keep saying that. I keep saying that an eye for an eye just leaves everybody blind, and that we've got to be able to to deal with ourselves. Something I do preach about is this, that there's a lousy side to all of us. There's a part of us that is miserable, and when aggravated and so forth, will show its claws. It's the way we are. Sometimes we get surprised at how miserable we really are, and people have not been mature enough, or not even have never been able to, maybe haven't been encouraged to really accept themselves as bad as they are. You see, to sort of Well, there's a say that there's a bright side and a dismal side to the moon. You know, there's part of us that's not that pleasant, and to accept, and then I not refuse to project that onto somebody else and hate it in somebody else, because usually people hurt that which they hate in themselves. They're always looking for some enemy, and of course, as someone said so wisely, the enemy's within. You know, we found the enemy within ourselves. So I preach about that to sort of don't be fighting against the bad side of yourself. That's the way you are, and the tension between that which is miserable in you and that which is noble is the stuff of life, and that's how we move along. It's part of how we were designed to kind of struggle. And it's that struggle that makes us into good people. If we could get that kind of attitude, then we wouldn't sort of say, "You're not my enemy, and I don't have enemies."
No. Do you feel that the people in your parish share your political points of view and your opinions of defense spending?
Yes, some do, some do not. See, some people are you know, have the classic approach that we must have, you know, a strong defense. You see, they always say defense. We must have a strong defense. And they go that route. And many people, too, have lost in wars. They lost a son in Vietnam, or they were in war themselves. And it's hard for them to put that part of themselves behind them. And you can't expect them to. But you invite them to that we can move past. What I want people to know is that we're at a barbaric level. We're, at least if two people were killing each other with knives, which is a gross and terrible thing to think about, well, if they did, they would know what they were doing, and they would have some consciousness of the reality of what they were doing. We have come to the most evil of situations where people can kill at a distance, and no contact between the killer and the killed. That is of like the dropping of the atomic bomb, or and the concept of button war, and that kind of terrible, terrible action where there's no contact. That's barbaric. So I invite people to really think about that. And we at this time in our history, and there are thousands of people in these United States and in Europe and in Russia and all over the world, are making a living by manufacturing weapons for the annihilation of the citizens, of the ordinary citizens. The weapons being made today are not made for war as we knew it. They are made in such a way that they are indiscriminate. They will kill the babies. They'll kill the old men who are dying and women. They will kill the handicapped. They will annihilate the entire people. And people unconsciously, and there's what I say is the important thing, is to somehow stir the consciousness that people begin to consider that they are making something for the annihilation of the innocent. And they have to think about that.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Father Michael Doyle of the Sacred Heart Church in Camden. And I'd like to change the subject a little bit and talk with you about a trip that you took less than a year ago to Northern Ireland.
Yes, yeah.
And you wrote an article for Today magazine, which I think a lot of our listeners may have read. I think your article was an attempt at making sense of what's happening there and of explaining to Americans who are, for the most part, very confused about the conflicts in Northern Ireland, what the roots of those conflicts are. You had spoken with Sean McBride, and he said to you that the British resent Ireland and that they blame Ireland for the dismemberment of the empire. Do you think that's true, and do you think that really has to do with the roots of the constant tensions between Northern Ireland and the British?
Well, I was sort of amused just a while ago listening to the president in his news conference where he, in speaking to the Polish people, he said this country, which is the United States, was born, he said, out of resistance to arbitrary power. Well, that arbitrary power was British. And resistance to that arbitrary power was the birth of these United States. I doubt if the president would apply that principle to the people of Ireland. And the people of Ireland were the first people in the whole world that England, the larger island by its east flank, invaded. There are two islands in the edge of Europe, Britain and Ireland, Ireland being the most western point of Europe. The big island, island of England invaded the small island of Ireland in 1169, which is a long time ago, 800 years ago. And since from that first adventure, they moved on around the world to the point that they would claim the sun never set on the British Empire. Well, it has come home to set now, and the last little piece of land that is now really occupied by the British is Ireland. And America was part of that. And the thing about the interesting thing about this struggle is, even though it's so long and so old, that the Irish people have never, ever accepted it. They've never settled down to say that's going to be the way that we're going to accept this invader. And so because of that, they have given example to America and to other parts of the world to resist, you see. That's why Sean McBride would say that the example, and that's a real example. George Washington said many occasions he spoke often about the inspiration of the Irish resistance to England and the power of that in this country. So when Sean McBride talks about that, the same thing happened in India. The Indian people were very much inspired by the people of Ireland. So he's saying that. And then there's the other factor about the British being slow to give up this last bit of empire. The British have a sort of an inflated notion of their own importance and worth, you know, and it's ritualized. It is in language. It is in their society. It's in the layers of hierarchical structure in the society and the importance and their lords and their ladies and all that kind of thing. And the monarchy. The monarchy in this day and age is about the best public relations gimmick existing. Now, when Prince Charles and married recently, which is not an original idea, getting married, it was interesting that the entire world went racing to see it. And the front pages of the most sophisticated newspapers in the Western world were just loaded with it. Somehow announcing that there's such an interest in this thing. And by having that thing, they kind of give the impression that some people are better than others. That if somebody is born from these two people, that person then is somewhat better. And so having a colony like Ireland sort of, supports that notion of superiority and so on. And something else that has really amused me in this country, and that is that how the American people subconsciously acknowledge that kind of superiority. And you'll see it when I came to this Delaware Valley first and took up the Sunday papers and took a look at the real estate section as suburbia began to move. Well, you never find Dublin Valley or Puerto Rican Heights or Harlem, Mall. It's Oxford and it's Windsor and it's all over the place. Because somehow the real estate people knew that they could give the illusion of something better, and indeed, what they even use the word openly exclusive, which is an ugly word in the English language. The British have made that nice, exclusive. That word is evil word. It is racist, you see. But somehow you'll see that advertisement, and you'll see it sometimes. What I'm saying about that subconscious stuff, but real. It's a hard thing then for the poor Irish people with their potatoes to be able to deal with this sophisticated and indeed subliminal or subconscious thing that's present of the superiority. And there's something there, and psychologically the British then would be loath to give up this island.
you, I know, are sympathetic with the goals of the IRA, and your father was in the IRA, but you're also a very nonviolent person, and the members of the IRA are known to have arms and to want money for more arms. What do you think of the tactics that they've been using?
Oh, I don't like the tactics. You know, I mean, I don't approve at all of the tactics, but the thing that one has to keep saying is that one is nonviolent and one is against violence. You see, but one has to be real about that. Unlike the president today who said violence begets violence, well, he approves the neutron bomb. See, that's the problem. See, that the notion that violence can become legitimate, if X number of people get together in the war room and say, yes, it's legitimate, there is no difference in my mind of the British violence and the IRA violence. It is violence. It's the method is the gun and the method is the execution of human beings. So there's no difference at all there. However, in the propaganda machine, it cranks out the word terrorism. So in my article, I just want to say that the British were the ultimate terrorists, you see, in Ireland. You know, and so when you use those words and throw them back on the other side, then you have to be consistent about violence. So I would condemn the British violence first, and then after that, then I would condemn the IRA violence.
If you live in Northern Ireland, what kind of day-to-day presence and governmental presence do the British have? How would you see the British presence in your day-to-day life, and how would they affect the policies and laws that you live under?
The first thing you would, if you cross the border of the Republic of Ireland, you'd have to cross over and you would be stopped by a lineup of British soldiers in camouflage uniform, and they would be with rifles, and they would be lying in the hedges. They'd be all around you. There'd be sandbag huts with rifles coming through them, and so then you know that there's something here. This is not a toll gate, or this is not a store. This is something. It would be like meeting Russian troops on the Ben Franklin Bridge. It's just where did they come from, and why are they there? And I have a great love for black people, but when one of them is a black man in Ireland, which doesn't have black people, not that that's any great thing that they don't have black people, but when you see a black man in a British uniform in Ireland, you say, oh, the oppressed have joined the oppressor. How did he come here? You know, it somehow announces it or something, that this is from outside. And so you go along the road, you get stopped, you get checked, you get that kind of thing. You go into a town, well, there's in Belfast, for example, while I was there, there was an English soldier with a rifle on almost every corner in Belfast. So the British troops are there. They're all armed. You see these big Saracen armored cars going down the street, and they're completely enclosed with two openings for the driver. And that would give you an idea. You see the barracks of the soldiers with the 20-foot barbed wire nets around them. That would tell you that, you know, it's an occupied area. It's not normal, you know.
I think another aspect that is very difficult for Americans to understand is the tensions between Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland.
Yes.
Can you do something to help explain that to us? What you wrote in your article about two apartment complexes, one which was largely Catholic and the other largely Protestant, and I think there was a 20-foot wall with barbed wire on top erected between them. What are some of the causes that go back to this
kind
of hostility?
The invasion of the northern part of Ireland, Ulster, which occurred in the beginning of the 17th century, it was deliberate. It was a military invasion, and people just took the land and drove off the people from their farms and so on, settled in and took it over, much like what was done here in terms of the Indians, not much different, you know, just take it over and take it. Although it was more settled than the poor Indians had settled it, and it was smaller. It was older, had a tradition. Now, by the time that invasion took place, something else had taken place. Was the fact that the British people had gone Protestant. They had they had changed from being belonging to the Catholic Church. And something else happened was that the monarchy of England, the king or the queen of England, became the head of the church. So you have the ultimate mix then of politics and religion, where the, as I say, the president of the nation is the head of my church. They invaded a Catholic country. So now you have this the Protestant then is the invader. And then, of course, there was tremendous destruction in Ireland wrought by, let's say, Oliver Cromwell, you know, in just previous to that, no, following that in 1649 or that time. And he approached Ireland with the same, approach as, let's say, in the Bible, where in the Old Testament, as we call it, that the Jewish people took over the promise, the people of Israel took over the promised land. But if you read the Bible, I mean, that looks wonderful, but at the same time, it has to be admitted that the great Bible announces they took the land by annihilating the inhabitants. And they thank God for delivering into their hands X amount of, you know, poor people that got executed and killed. Well, that was the approach of the fundamentalist Cromwellian Puritan attitude in Ireland. He gave thanks galore for all the people that were killed. So now those kind of things would, first of all, the Protestant is an invader to the Catholic. The Protestant took my father's land, shall we say, in and so forth. The persecution of the Catholics came from the Protestant English people. So you set up an unworkable tension between these two peoples. And there was no way you could resolve it because it was religious, political, and economic. No, they were just divided and you could never put them back together again.
So the Catholics lost their power base as well as their land.
They lost their land, their power base, and so forth. And, of course, their people. So when the treaty with Ireland was signed in 1922, that part of Ireland, which had the heavy concentration of Protestant people, they didn't want to belong to Ireland. They wanted to be in Ireland and be British. The very opposite to what the American people wanted. They wanted to be independent of Britain. These people would fight to be dependent. They did not want to be Irish. And so they wanted to be in the island of Ireland and be British. And that's the way it is, still to this very day.
You met the Supreme Commander of the Ulster Defence Association. What were your impressions of him?
Well, of course, he's interesting because he's the head of a paramilitary group, something the same as the IRA. Some people estimate his membership at 33,000, others at 50,000 people. And the UDA, the Ulster Defence Association, have killed a lot of people, and they make no bones about it. I asked him about the shooting of Bernadette Devlin. And he didn't deny it at all. He said she was a prime target because she was involved in the struggle and that they would not kill ordinary people, though they have done that. And, you know, killing is killing, you know, and the IRA have killed a lot of innocent people too, you know. But what was extraordinary about the visit was the fact that the cool way he could sit there in his office and be interviewed and talk about it and at the same time survive and not be made illegal. And, of course, membership of the IRA could get you 7 years, you know, in prison in Northern Ireland, but membership of the UDA wouldn't get you anything. So he was an interesting fellow and very pleasant fellow. And the thing about him is that he could be worse, you know, than he is. But the fact that he exists is quite a thing. He wants an independent province in the north of Ireland, which is neither Irish or British. We'd call it Ulster, by the name of the province and set up an independent. He believes that the British will pull out eventually and that he will not join with the rest of Ireland, and so he's working for an independent Ulster. And of course that would be better than they have. Many people say, well, if they go that route, then the Catholics will be annihilated, you know, because there's the other factor is that the Catholics do not get permits for guns, but the Protestants do.
Really?
That's true.
If you're Catholic, you can't get a permit, and if you're a Protestant, you can't?
Yes.
What's the reason for that?
Because, you see, the Protestant people would consider the Catholic people as part of the Irish Ireland, and that the Catholic people would want eventually to have this little island united. That the Catholic people, on the whole, would not want to be British. So they would look upon them as an enemy. You see, that they in their hearts, they would want to be... Their allegiance is to the... Well, first of all, their religion connects them with the worldwide Catholic faith. The Protestant faith of the people of Ireland, Northern Ireland, would connect them with British monarchy. So... They wouldn't get guns for, you know, that's why the UDA would know going in to burn that Devlin's house there was no weapon there. They would know that. Because they would know that from the official forces that there was no gun there. And see, that's why, for example, the Reverend Paisley, when he has these marches in Ulster, why he has at the end of the march many times he has the people raise their hands and waive their permit. It would be illegal to waive their gun, but it's not illegal to waive their permit. So it's an announcement, you know, that we have the weapons, you know.
You've had the chance to talk to a lot of people in the Delaware Valley about your impressions of Northern Ireland since you returned. What kind of reactions have you gotten from people? Because I really do think that this is one of the more confusing conflicts that face us in America who haven't done a lot of studying about Northern Ireland.
The reaction has been good on the whole. People are trying to understand it. The situation is the worst. It's a casualty of bad religion and bad politics. That's what it is. The whole world should look at it as to what this kind of mess that can be made when people mix up religion and politics and use both oppressively. What happens? What an unworkable thing is created. And in trying to sift through it, people have to sort of begin to understand that this little island of Ireland is so very small. It's the same size as the state of Maine. The whole thing. The fact that it's divided, and the fact that the British have created a monster, they have designed it in such a way that it's unworkable. Now, some of the leaders on the nationalist side say, well, that it's like this, that the marriage, this effort to unite the Catholics and the Protestants is like a marriage. And it cannot be consummated as long as the third person's in the room. So you have to remove this fallback thing of the old allegiance to England, and let these two groups on this land get on about the fact of human life and let England pull out of it. And what I blame England for essentially now is, no point saying, well, I blame the person today for what happened yesterday. That really it's not real. Like my name, for example, is Doyle, and the Gaelic of that is Thule, which means black foreigner. So I was a Dane or a Norman or some coming with armor into Ireland. So somebody could, if they blame me for that, I mean, I don't know what to do about it. So what I'm saying is the British people should begin to see this is never going to work. You're never going to be able to make this work. It's just, so announce an intent that by... And 10 years from now, they're going to pull out lock, stock, and barrel. And in the meantime, let's know that we got to work it out and get together and make this thing work and get on with it. But it's that's the reality. So it dangles there. And people say the same thing they said about Vietnam, there'd be a massacre if they pull out. Well, it's going to be a worse massacre. You know, and after all, the number of people killed in Northern Ireland is not. It's because they come one by one that it seems like an awful. In the city of Philadelphia, there's a murder a day. There are about 400 people murdered in Philadelphia in 1 year. And a great number of people who are murdered come out of an economic conflict. But that's not looked upon with such anxiety. But it's the same problem. It's the problem of oppressed people. And they react badly, you see. And so I'm saying that has to be, wherever there's oppression, there will be violence. And wherever there's violence, there will be more violence. So the if, for example, there could be an intent like that from the British, and then there could be an effort by the European Common Market to get involved in trying to solve this terrible, you know, hurtful thing that is present in Ireland for so long. The American government certainly could help in some kind of plan, like their Marshall Plan, to sort of, you know. So it could be done. It could be done.
Well, thank you very much for sharing your views on Northern Ireland and also for telling us about your work in Camden. Thanks, really.
Okay. You're welcome.
I've been speaking with Father Michael Doyle, and he's the pastor at Sacred Heart Church in Camden.